We had the blood moon, if you got up early enough to see it. Wasn't really red when I looked, but Lisa says it was pretty red through her binoculars. It's Today in Ohio, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. I'm Chris Quinn. I am here with Lisa Garvin, as well as Layla Tassi and Laura Johnston. Let's get to it. It's election day, finally, and after today, all those campaign signs littering Northeast Ohio have no purpose. So what is an environmentally conscious person supposed to do with the sign that has been in their yard this season? Laura, can they just chuck them in the recycling bin? And this is particularly important in my neighborhood because people in Cleveland Heights love these political signs.
No, do not do that. Do not wish cycle them like you do with strawberry cartons and sour cream containers.
Because wish cycle.
I love that.
That means when you try to recycle something that's not recyclable,
you just wish it were recyclable.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny.
So this could be really damaging. Not only if you try to recycle it, it could maybe contaminate your entire recycling bin, but the metal wires that stick in the ground, they could get wrapped around the sorting equipment at a facility, create a hazard for workers or damage equipment. I mean, those metal prongs are sharp. So you can bring your yard signs one at a time or in bulk to the Solid Waste District headquarters in Garfield Heights. And many municipalities also offer drop-off times for the yard signs or allow for a special pickup, and then they take them to Garfield Heights. And then there's a place in Willoughby called North Coast Recycling that actually does recycle them. And there are four primary components. There's paper, corrugated plastic, plastic film, and metal. And they bale the plastic. They sell it to compounders who convert it into pellets for use in making a variety of items, from plastic bags to toys. And then obviously paper is recyclable and metal is recyclable.
Okay. Well, I figured it was appropriate to begin and end the podcast today with something election related.
I feel like it's probably less satisfying to like put them in a recycling facility than it is to like chuck them in your trash can. But I do feel like I wish I could like throw out all the ads. At least those are way more annoying than the signs, and they'll be gone too.
Well, people have to get the signs out if they want to put up their big inflatable Santa Claus. So. It's Today in Ohio. Tearing down a decrepit house is a lot cheaper than renovating it. So what is the argument behind Cleveland spending $5 million in stimulus money to renovate abandoned houses? Layla, this is an interesting tactic.
Yeah, this is part of Mayor Justin Bibbs' Housing for All initiative. He's proposed creating a $5 million loan pool for renovating vacant and abandoned houses. This would be a revolving loan fund to initially restore 100 properties. So that's an average of about $50,000 per home. But, you know, as you said, Chris, the cost of restoring a decrepit home is far more than demolition, which is about $10,000 per property. So our Stimulus Watch reporter, Lucas DiPrilli, explored that question of whether these renos are worth it. And the answer, it seems, is that it really depends on where the house is and how many other blighted properties are around it. Frank Ford, a senior policy advisor at Western Reserve Land Conservancy, and he's one of our go-to housing gurus, told Lucas that if a property is the only vacant house on the street, restoring it benefits everyone because perhaps that one house was suppressing everybody else's home values. On the other hand, renovating a house on a street where there are multiple vacant properties might be unwise because those other blighted houses will undermine your investment. In that case, demo is probably the best course. So Ford told Lucas that after the Great Recession, he preferred demo to deal with the scourge of abandoned houses because it was an overwhelming problem at that time. There were 15,000 of them in the city, but now that number is closer to 5,000. So Ford likes a mixed approach that includes rehab where it makes sense.
Well, and it's also got to be based on the condition. I mean, a lot of these old houses have good old bones. They were built with fir timber when that was old growth timber. But if it's rotted, if you have to replace pretty much the whole substructure, I can't imagine that that's worthwhile. They must have some sort of grading system they use to determine whether a house is worth saving.
Well, I would assume that the market will bear this out too, don't you think? I mean, anyone who's applying for one of these loans, it has to have some sense of whether the house that they're targeting is worth the effort. So it, you know, I think that, you know, individuals who are getting involved in this program are going to know what they're doing, hopefully.
Well, if you can save them, you should save them. I have an old house, and I could tell you the stuff that they built it with doesn't compare to what they build them with today. So if you can keep it going, they can last for centuries, whereas I'm not sure a modern house can. Interesting use of the money. It sounds like there's a bit of a debate about it, but it seems like it's a wise move.
But I have a question, though. So would these be going to owner-occupied homes? Or would it
they're not occupied.
They're abandoned. Okay, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess it would be someone who'd be maybe looking to occupy the home or looking to flip it or something like that. But yeah. So. Yeah. Interestingly, I was having similar debate with Lucas a few weeks back when Justin Bibbs' lead abatement program was before city council for approval, because in that case, they're putting a chunk of ARPA money toward abating the worst lead laden properties, but. Lead abatement is expensive too, especially if you're going to do it right so that the problem never recurs at a house. But some Cleveland homes aren't even worth the cost of abating the lead. And so, you know, we were having this very similar discussion as this one about what's worth it.
Okay. You're listening to Today in Ohio. If you have ever used Cuyahoga County's increasingly antiquated system for looking up deeds and mortgages online, you know how clunky it was. And it's been replaced. Lisa, what's the story?
Yeah, it's called the Official Record Search website. Cuyahoga County is the first in Ohio to use this system called GovOS. It's a digital record system, and this is a pilot program for possible expansion. So the county's real estate services administrator, Brian O'Malley, says that now mortgages, deeds, leases, and et cetera, dating back to July of 1810, are now online and searchable. Also, title companies, title attorneys, and other people can file their documents online starting December 1st, and he promises that document processing will be much faster. And, you know, they'll also be bypassing a third party by doing these online. This will also work with the current My Place property search website. They'll be working together. The current system is 20 years old. It was custom built, and the vendor that built it has gone out of business. So O'Malley was worried if they had a failure, you know, they would have to start from scratch anyway. So this new site is cuyahoga.ohio.publicsearch.us. It has built-in cloud security. Records are encrypted to discourage hackers and ransomware. So yeah, 1810, that's quite a feat to go back that far.
Well, I'm a records nerd. So when I first moved here, nothing was online. I had to go down to the county building and search through deeds, and I got it back to when my house was built, but not before. When the system went online, it was god-awful. I mean, you'd have to do all sorts of stuff, and then getting to the document was painful, and it would gum up your computer. So, in preparation for this discussion, I went on yesterday to see how easy it was to use, and oh my gosh, it's like so simple. I was able to track the land that my house is on back through, I think, five more owners to when it was just a meadow, and figure out the whole history of it. In no time. It took me literally minutes. So anybody that's searching for the history of their house, Laura Johnston did that great story about a year ago about the history of her house before her renovation project pretty much put her into a cave. And now anybody can go and search the history of their house really easily. It's such an upgrade from what they had. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost has filed suit against a second dollar store chain. Which one is it? And what does Yost say it did? And should we take note that he did this on the very eve of Election Day when he's on the ballot for re-election? Laura.
And it really was the eve. I mean, it was like 5 o'clock when this news release came out, but he did. He filed a lawsuit against Family Dollar. This is claiming that the Virginia-based company charged prices at checkout that were higher than advertised on store shelves, which is very similar to what he alleged last week with a similar suit against Dollar General. These are both in Butler County, too, which I found interesting. So this lawsuit asks that Family Dollar repay all customers hurt by the company's bait advertising and impose a civil penalty of $25,000 for each infraction. That's a lot of money if we're talking about a lot of infractions. And he wants to issue a permanent injunction preventing Family Dollar from putting deceptively low prices on store signs. And Family Dollar is owned by Dollar Tree. They bought it in 2015. And apparently when they did this, they issued a press release saying they were targeting lower and middle income households throughout urban and rural locations. So it's pretty clear what they're trying to do. And I mean, I'm all for charging the prices that you think you're going to be paying, which is a little more complicated apparently at Family Dollar than the Dollar Tree, where everything is $1.25.
Why isn't it a dollar?
Because they raised prices this year.
So why isn't it called the $1.25 tree?
I just don't think it's as catchy, maybe.
So you're right. This press release, you and I were talking on the phone when this thing rolled across, and it was, I think, after 5 o'clock. So is this just Yost trying to get into the consciousness one last time before people go to the polls today?
I don't know. I saw his ad last night while I was watching Jeopardy with the kids, and he didn't mention it in that. So it hasn't been part of his campaign literature that I've seen. But he is going after dollar stores. I feel like, you know, we've talked a lot about how Cleveland City Council was really anti-dollar store. And OSHA recently has put out some releases about inspections of dollar stores where they found problems with trip hazards, stacks of merchandise were unstable, electrical panels that were blocked, fire extinguishers not accessible. So it feels like the entire government is cracking down on dollar stores. And I feel like, you know, we'll probably be talking about doing a deeper dive after the election.
But he's a former reporter, and he knows that by releasing that last night, he would be in every form of media today and on this podcast.
That's true. Yeah. You're true. I don't want to underestimate Dave Yost.
What did you say, Layla?
The bait. I said, look who took the bait.
We did. We're talking about it. So way to go, Dave Yost. You played us.
Yeah.
It's today in Ohio. Each of Cleveland's five police districts has a single two-person crisis intervention team, which doesn't really fit anymore with today's police strategy of de-escalating tense situations. Layla, does the city have a plan to address this?
Yeah, you know, these crisis intervention teams are so important. They consist of mental health professionals who are deployed to emergency calls involving someone facing a mental health crisis instead of just sending police. And the city has been piloting this program in each of the districts, and they've been very effective. In 2021, 98% of crisis intervention incidents were resolved without an arrest, and 85% were solved without using handcuffs. So that is a huge improvement over what we've seen in the past, where people often would find themselves not only, you know, in jail or, you know, sometimes injured by police. So last night, City Council approved Justin Bibb's proposal to double the size of these teams. So there will be four operating in each police district. Plus, there will be a mental health strategist set to be paid $135,000 for 3 years, and they'll help inform the city's decision on which of two approaches to invest in. You've got the co-responder approach, where police accompany the crisis responders on calls, and then you've got the care response, which is when the crisis responders go alone to those calls. And I believe, you know, the additional coverage allows the crisis intervention teams to cover more hours, you know, into the evening and things like that. So headed in the direction of a more robust response to people facing mental health care crisis.
Well, you've got to give him a salute. This was part of his campaign pledge to try and do more de-escalation. And he's had a tough few months with bad news, but this is living up to a promise, and it's an important thing. So
yeah, I mean, you know, the police have been under a federal consent decree here in Cleveland for what, the better part of a decade now, and this change in their approach to mental health related calls could be really one of the most important steps they've taken in the direction of constitutional policing. I really think that this initiative would not only deliver better and more compassionate service to people experiencing mental health crises, but for police officers, working in proximity to these compassionate caregivers could inspire a cultural change in the department, even if it's subtle at first. So all around, you know, this is great.
Well, it takes money too. I mean, you can say all this stuff, but unless you actually invest in it, it doesn't mean anything. And he's investing in it. So good move by the mayor. It's today in Ohio. The National Teacher of the Year from right here in Northeast Ohio gave a speech at the City Club Monday, and Foursquare addressed the nonsense going on in Ohio in which people are playing politics with the curriculum. Lisa, how did he say he would react to any kind of overreach with regard to what is taught in the classroom?
Yeah, we're talking about Kurt Russell. He's been an Oberlin High School teacher for 25 years, and he told the audience at the City Club that he will not stop teaching controversial subjects, despite a push by state lawmakers to ban certain curricula under the umbrella of CRT. He says, I want to provide a holistic education, and taking away certain books and subjects just won't allow him to do that. So Russell, back in 2006, developed classes that he now teaches, African American history, and then race, gender, and oppression. And he said that, you know, he developed these classes in response to student demand. He covers women's rights, economic oppression, issues in Black America, LGBTQ issues. And he said that, you know, we need to know about these things. He said he would also like to see more Black teachers, especially men. Only 2% of teachers in America are Black men. And he would like to see diversification of education at all levels, starting, you know, with the State Board of Education on down. And he says that he was really inspired by his kindergarten teacher in Oberlin. She was a white woman, and most of her class was Black. And so she, you know, got books on Martin Luther King and other issues that would be of interest to her Black students. So she saw the need, and she saw the need for students to see themselves in their lessons.
The New Yorker magazine has a phenomenal story about a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, about how the CRT movement in America was pretty much fictitious and how a bunch of people built it to try and mobilize politically, but really cause problems for school districts. It's just a tremendous piece of writing. And it's a reminder that in this country, we had people for political gain really messing with the schools. So it was great to see the Teacher of the Year at the City Club of Cleveland stand up against that kind of thing. And this is when the City Club calendar came out. This was clearly going to be one of the highlights. And he didn't just talk, you know, about being a teacher. He addressed one of the most sinister forces in education today head on, and it was great to see.
It really was, and I know there are other educators who believe the way he does, but for him to vocalize it, I think, you know, made everyone, you know, stronger in that.
Yeah, great stuff. You can watch City Club speeches at the City Club website. They have them on there, and it's all free. It's Today in Ohio. I wonder if one reason for this next story is Cleveland's refusal to pay people who worked from home during the pandemic their income tax refunds. Nobody I know is getting them. One of the region's biggest employers is abandoning Cleveland for the suburbs. Who is it, and what is the official reason, income tax refund hassles notwithstanding, Laura?
Medical Mutual, and they certainly didn't mention this to us, but they are the income tax issue. But they are leaving the Rose Building downtown. It's a well-known building right on 9th Street, and they're coming to the wide-open interstate spaces of Brooklyn, where they already do have a building in the old American Greetings headquarters. So in an email to employees, Medical Mutual, which is obviously an insurance company, said that in January they would start to move workers in phases. But basically they said a lot of people are already working remotely. It doesn't make sense to have two offices, and they only have about 250 employees downtown and 900 in Brooklyn, with more than 2,800 employees total. So this is a fraction of their total workforce.
Well, I think the workers are speaking. It's easier to drive out to the suburb. Parking is a lot easier. There's been some crime downtown of late, too, that's probably got people scared. And I'm betting that secretly or quietly, they're grumbling about not getting their tax refunds. Brooklyn is a welcoming place. It's where our newsroom currently is, although we continue to look for a spot downtown. So I'm not surprised by this at all. I wouldn't be surprised to see some more. I wonder what happens to that building. So many buildings downtown have switched from offices to apartments, which is actually hurtful to the Cleveland economy because they get tax abated when they do that. Was there any discussion of what's next for that building?
I think they're going to try to see if it gets filled. They said they take their role as a corporate citizen seriously. They continue to support organizations that address the need of their neighbors throughout the state. But they're not really, and they're saying they're still committed to Cleveland, but I don't think there's an answer yet for that piece of real estate. And it is prime. It's pretty, right? Like if you walk right there on East 9th, you always looked into the cafeteria and there's a ton of windows right on the street level. And it's, a pretty ornate building. It's not like one of those bland, faceless office buildings.
No. And look, companies make their commitment in ways beyond just having a residency in the city. I mean, Medical Mutual's gifts to nonprofits and its work in the community is pretty wise. And we should say our former president is a chief poobah over there, Andrea Hogman. So wish him well in Brooklyn. They'll be right down the street from us. We'll be able to go over there and have lunch in their wonderful cafeteria. It's Today in Ohio. Cuyahoga County is projected to see more than 600 overdose deaths by the end of the year, with fentanyl continuing to be the leading cause. Layla, what's going on? Why isn't this epidemic stopping?
I know. The numbers are just staggering. Reporter Olivia Mitchell tells us that we're headed for another year of more than 600 drug overdose deaths, and fentanyl is really leading those numbers. Last year, we had 668. In 2017, we hit a high of 727. As of October 31st, there were 419 overdose deaths. Then the vast majority of those are heroin or fentanyl related. And June was the deadliest month for overdoses, when there were 67 deaths. And that led the medical examiner's office to issue a public health warning in July, because the county recorded 30 overdoses in the first 11 days of that month. In just 4 days, 15 people died. So it's just an awful battle. The Adams Board cautions people to use measures to protect themselves against overdose. While they obviously don't condone drug use, they say that if you're going to use with others, carry naloxone, which is a drug that can reverse the effects of opioids, and use test strips to test your drugs, because fentanyl is appearing in different kinds of drugs, even resembling prescription pills. In fact, the board will be using state grant money to install 5 vending machines that contain test strips and other items for users, and 447 emergency naloxone, 447 emergency naloxone cabinets will be installed throughout the county. Again, the board is not condoning drug use. They just want people to survive.
Well, this is all unintentional. These are people that think they're getting a certain kind of drug. It ends up being far more potent and it kills them. And we had 2 deaths in the jail last week that I bet when we get the toxicology back, it's going to be exactly that. This stuff's just so potent. And the easiest way for people to avoid it is those test strips. And they should just be handing those out on the street at this point.
Yeah.
It's Today in Ohio. Okay, as we said at the top of the podcast, it's election day, and we've done a poll on what the top topics are for voters as they head to the polls. Lisa, there's not really any surprises, but it's worth talking about. What is Northeast Ohio most concerned about as they vote?
I thought there were a couple of surprises on this list, quite frankly. But yeah, in our survey, we surveyed 500 Northeast Ohio residents, and they got to choose up to 2 issues that they're most concerned about from a list. By far, inflation was at the top of the list, just as it is nationally. 54% of those surveyed said that was their most concerning issue. Abortion came in a distant second at 21%. And then going down the list, healthcare, 18%, jobs, 16%, state of democracy, 14%, climate change, kind of low at 13%, the war in Ukraine, 10%, immigration, kind of low, I thought, but we'll break it down by party later. Immigration, 9%, only 9% thought that was a top issue. Election security, only 7%. Education, 7%, and then criminal justice came in last with only 4%.
So before you get to the party breakdowns, though, I do think it's worth stressing what's down low. Local television tries to scare the bejesus out of people by talking about crime nonstop, and elsewhere in the nation, crime is high. Not here. Education. We talked earlier about the whole CRT effort to sow distrust of schools and teachers. We did a previous survey specifically about that. People in Northeast Ohio aren't worried about education. And election security was a bit of a surprise, because there's so much effort being made by Fox News and Tucker Carlson and others to undermine faith in the election system. in Northeast Ohio, it's not working.
Yeah, which is kind of, you know, encouraging, you know, if you ask me. So as we break it down by a political party, we'll look at inflation again. There's a huge gap here. 72% of Republicans surveyed said that inflation is their top issue. That's a 31-point spread from Democrats. Only 41% said it was a big thing. Abortion, another huge gap. 30% of Democrats thought it was the most important issue, only 11% of the GOP, an 11-point spread. And then, I'm sorry, my math is bad. And so when we look at immigration, here's a real big gap. 21% of the GOP people surveyed said that was their most important issue. Only 2% of Democrats said the same thing.
Yeah, and I swear that all comes down to who was watching Fox News. if you're constantly told by your television news program that immigration is a problem, even when you're in Ohio, way away from the southern border, you start to believe it. These numbers don't surprise me because we have a form of state media for the Republican Party giving people nonsense, and obviously some of them are believing it.
And I wonder if our distance from the southern border might have something to do with those lower, you know, immigration numbers, but I don't know.
Look, if you live in Ohio, immigration is not a concern. That's just silly that it's talked about as it is. Whereas inflation, I think lots of people are worried about how that's gotten out of control for the first time in 40 years. But the party differences, I wonder if you compared this to party differences before Fox News existed, whether that gap would be a lot smaller. I don't know how you combat that. It used to be that you couldn't do what Fox News does. You had to be balanced, and they just peddle falsehoods to people. And obviously some people believe it. I still get notes from people arguing that CRT is a problem in our schools, that the election was stolen, and I'm just a fool who can't see the evidence. They try to quote that ridiculous phony documentary 2000 Mules, which is constantly talked about on Fox News. But that gap, has it ever been bigger in America than it is now between the two parties and what they fear?
Yeah.
Do we know if the respondents were equally divided between Democrats and Republicans?
I don't know. They wait for it, though. I mean, we work with Baldwin Wallace and Tom Sutton and Lauren Copeland are really good about making sure that it's scientifically balanced.
So what do you think these results mean for the election? I mean, given that, you know, the number one issue is inflation, do you think that, and we thought, you know, everyone's been talking about how abortion is going to bring a lot of people out to vote, but it seems to be a distant second. Do you think that this signals a red wave in Ohio?
I don't know that people just automatically think if inflation's a problem, Republicans will fix it. I mean, I know with abortion, if people feel strongly about abortion rights, they know that the Republicans are not going to fix it. I have no idea. It's impossible to predict. No polls are useful. And I mean, Lee Weingart believes he's going to win the county executive's race. I would have thought that would be impossible, but he's convinced he's going to win. Who knows? Anybody predicting in the Senate race? Anybody want to go on the record in the podcast and predict?
Ryan by 5 points.
Oof. Wow.
Wow. Wow.
I can't predict. I have no clue. I just don't have any clue what's going to happen. All right. That's it for Today in Ohio. A short one. Thanks, Lisa. Thanks, Layla. Thanks, Laura. Come back tomorrow. We will be talking about the results of the election. It'll probably be an all-election episode. Thanks for listening.